is The Unseen. And I'm your host, Mike Cleland. On this episode, I will be talking with my friend Greg Bishop, and together we will wrestle with the very thorny subject of UFOs. And both of us try to address the challenges of how to make sense out of this elusive subject. Now, Greg is somewhat of an expert. He has written a handful of books, including the very important book, Project Beta. And that book is subtitled, The Story of Paul Benowitz, National Security and the Creation of a Modern UFO Myth. This book was published in 2005, and it has come to define the foggy netherworld of how elements of our government have co-opted the UFO to their own ends. He has also written It Defies Language, Essays on UFOs and Other Weirdness, as well as Wake Up Down There, and these books are both collections of his essays on UFOs and other weirdness. Our conversation runs a little bit long, so no need to say any more here in the intro. Greg does a much better job of speaking for himself than I do in trying to introduce him. This was a fun conversation, and was recorded on Wednesday, December 23rd, 2019. Please enjoy. Greg, I want to thank you so much for saying yes to this interview. It means a lot to me.
I will talk to you anytime, Mike, because we've known each other for so long. I mean, when did we talk first and do an interview on your show? Like 10 years ago or something ridiculous like that?
It was a decade ago, and we also met, I recall, in person and hung out. You know where we met? We met at Stanton Friedman's desk, his table, at the UFO conference in Laughlin, Nevada.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense, and I think I remember it.
Yeah.
You and I have been to so many of those things. I remember when you went and you came a few months ago and stayed at my house, and we had a really nice time, talked quite a bit, and I forgot to have you sign the Reframing the Debate poster.
I signed it.
You did?
I did. Oh, yeah. Well, you pulled it out. We unrolled it. I signed it.
Oh, God. Thanks.
Okay.
Oh, thank God. Because I was like, Mike was here for like 4 days. He didn't sign. Okay, good.
Yeah, so I signed it. And that was a year ago. That was a year and a few months ago. So, yeah. So.
I've got almost everybody on there. There's like, I think three on there. So I take it with me when I'm going to see people that are were in the book.
Hey, let's fill people in. The book is a book by Robbie Graham. It's called UFOs Reframing the Debate, and it's a collection of essays that he played the editor, and he wrote the foreword. And actually, the foreword was Diana, wasn't it?
Yeah. Diana Walsh-Pasulka wrote the foreword, and Robbie wrote the intro. And then, yeah, there were 14 of us in that book Red Pill. That was his first big published thing, I believe.
Yeah, the cover. He did the cover, too.
Yeah, he did the cover. Do you know what that cover is based on? And not too many people know this. I think I told you this when you were visiting.
Oh, what is it?
It's based because he had the basic design of the two hands framing the UFO that was kind of out of register with the colors.
Yep.
And he said, I can't think of what to put around it. I don't know. You know, he was trying to get a really good idea of what his design was. And it's based around Botticelli's Annunciation. If you look at that painting. There are two hands, Mary and Gabriel, angel. I'm an art history major. That's my only degree. When Gabriel came to tell Mary she was pregnant with Jesus, anyway, so she's understandably freaked out. So it's very theatrical. But the hands in the middle, her hand is up and kind of like an oh my god, and his hand is like calm down. There's something cool I got to tell you, and all that. The negative space in between those two hands is the center of all the converging one-point perspective because it's an Italian Renaissance painting.
Yep.
So what it is what's going on in that negative space in between the two hands is the most important part of the painting, not their reactions, not the room, not the little branch he has in his hand. The most important part of that painting is that message that's passing between them in that negative space. And so I talked to Red Pill about that, and we were talking about his hands, and instead of the negative space, there's a UFO in there. And I thought, yeah, you know what, there's a parallel here. It's an unspeakable thing that we talk around that we can't really define. If we try to define it, it slips out. And if you look at the painting, there's concentric circles coming out of it just by you know, Mary's dress and other things in the painting that looks like a bullseye. And the bullseye is the center, is that negative space. So he put crosswords like around it with little words. You can see them very vaguely, very lightly. It's square because it's like a crossword puzzle or whatever those like.
What are, They're called find a word. They're word search things.
Yeah. Word search thing. It looks like a word search thing, but there's like, you know, terms from the book in there.
Disclosure.
And it's, and so those little things function almost as a bullseye, except there's not a negative space. The negative space is the UFO. Anyway, we talked about this for 2 hours over a phone call, and I didn't tell him how to do it. I just said, look at that painting. That's a really, it's composed very well. It's a graphic designer's dream. See what you can do with that. And he got inspired to finish it off by from that painting, from the Annunciation by Sandro Botticelli.
Wonderful. And then, so this is exactly what happens every time we talk, is that like I have full confidence we are going to start one place and conversations are going to loop back around, and who knows where we'll end up. This will not fall into the category of formal interview.
I never do those on my show. I tell people right up front, it's like, this is not a formal interview. If there's something you want to say, even if it has to do with, you know, we got into food and aircraft design and all kinds of stuff on my show. It's not just UFOs and paranormal. I want to know what the person's interested in.
When I was at your house, the first thing you did is you took me into this long hallway. It was kind of dark and kind of, you know, mysterious looking. And one wall of that hallway was floor to ceiling bookshelves. And this is like a pretty long hallway.
Yeah, it's probably about 15 feet, maybe a little longer.
Probably a little longer than that, I bet. Yeah. So, and then we got kind of sidetracked and sucked into the UFO section of your bookshelf there. You know, Nick Redfern put this thing up on Facebook recently. He basically said, I do not have a library. I just have a bookshelf, you know, but you have a library.
Yes, there is a library at the house. You know, probably 3/4 of the books are mine, a quarter or a third or whatever my wife's. And we both have books in the garage. So eventually, you know, I want to get a big room and just have, as you know, it's everybody's fantasy, have a library.
Absolutely.
You know, with, you know, because right now I just have it organized. Books about California history, books about, these are all fiction. This shelf is all occult books. And then this shelf is all conspiracies. And this shelf is all UFOs, which is like 3 of the 8-foot long shelves are completely UFO books.
So give us the highlights of what's in there. I mean, there was just a bunch of autographed John Keel books. And
2 autographed John Keel books, which I had him autograph himself when I met him. One of the books is J'ai Dû, which was his first book. It was about him traveling through the Middle East and the Far East and the Middle East and finding out what he was very interested in magicians and fakirs and stuff like that. So that was his like adventure travel log book.
And that must have been what, in the '50s or?
Yeah, it was like the mid-50s, I think. Maybe early '50s actually, because it was
so
when
that's
he was
the same time
out of the army, huh?
Oh, that was, we're talking over each other, which I apologize. I'm awful.
That's so. Okay. That's how radio works.
I mean, that was in Kerouac's On the Road kind of.
Yeah. It's John Keel's On the Road, I think. And the other John Keel I have is The Fickle Finger of Fate, which is a softcore porno novel by John Keel.
I that was always in his bio that he, you know, augmented his income a little bit through over the years.
I showed that to him and he said, oh my God, I haven't seen one. I don't even have one of these, he said. And I said, well, can you sign it? So he wrote, to Greg Bishop, my favorite editor and collector of high class literature.
Right on.
So I treasure that. There's, one of the shelves, most of the shelf is signed books because, you know, if I got to have a book and I can possibly get it signed by whoever. So, you know, there are signed books by Bud Hopkins and Whitley and Stan Friedman and, you know, everybody you can think of, Dolan, Rich Dolan.
Me.
You? Yes.
There's a couple of them, yeah.
Of course.
Good. Yeah. So that was, I mean, I could get, that was, I was getting sort of sucked into that. That was like one of those things. I had a really big bookshelf and I had a lot of comic books and art books and stuff. And I was a horrible place to have a party at my cabin when I lived out west because all my books, because people would just get kind of like, whoa, they'd get kind of sidetracked and everyone would be kind of staring at these like old comic books and stuff. So.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, the UFO Encyclopedia, both volumes, the first one when it came out when it was in three parts, and then the second edition, which was alphabetical. But I was doing Excluded Middle at the time, and I got review copies, which was like, you know, who could have thunk of the luck of getting review copies of the UFO Encyclopedia by Jerome Clark, which everybody, if you're serious about the UFO subject, whether you agree with Jerome Clark or not, I mean, he tried to be it's a monumental undertaking he had. And he's very even-handed about it. And it's I've used those encyclopedias multiple times just to get, you know, either to get information or to find out where I can find the information.
Absolutely.
So those are amazing. And the I've got a facsimile edition, folio edition, like a foot high of the John Dee book. The John Dee's A True and Faithful Relation of What Passed Between for Many Years Between John Dee and Some Spirits, which has all of his, you know, experience. And it's all in like this weird arcane Latin. So I actually have, you know, I have a version of it that's translated. But yeah, it's John Dee's account of starting a conversation with a being that he and Edward Kelly channeled. And during the Elizabethan period in England, he was the court astrologer and also an alchemist and a magician and all that other stuff. But basically, at that point, that was a learned person. That was a man of science, even though it wasn't called science yet. And science at that point, or whatever you want to call it, included all types of knowledge of things, natural science, normal things that we think of as science, but then also mystical things or things we think of as mystical now. So that's why that's very interesting to me.
A question I always have now, just so the Venn diagram, you know, the two circles, you know, they kind of overlap and they, so you have one study, the study of the occult or one category, one, and then the other one would be UFOs. Where do they overlap? What's in that little thing where they overlap?
Your personal interest.
Okay. I'm just asking because it comes up a lot where this occult stuff shows up all the time in this lore. And I don't know what to make of it. I don't have a good answer to that question.
It's because I think the occult thing is another way of looking at reality that's kind of been lost. And in some ways that's bad. In other ways it's not. But it is a method of getting at truths that I don't think can be gotten at by data or the main tools of science, which are very important in this field. But I think the intuitive, the subjective, the mythological, the numinous, all those things, if you talk to somebody that's had a UFO experience, all that stuff's happened to them. And that's not data. I guess it could be if you're a sociologist, but it's not a raw row of data. It's a personal experience. And those things, I think it's coming back now. But for the longest time, people have ignored how people are affected, how their lives are changed, all those things. And I think the occult side speaks to that because a lot, to me, occultism, especially Western occultism, is an attempt to understand the world, your place in it, how you interact with it and what you bring to that world. It's basically one of the oldest forms of self-help, I think.
And then what you just said, that the UFO is, I'm going to talking about the UFO subject has got like so many categories. I'm just going to go right to the category interests me, which would be the contact experience. So yes, exactly. This is you're dealing with something absolutely subjective. You're dealing with something that is steeped in this kind of Dr. John Mack used the term reified metaphor, like where a metaphor is made real. So we have a real experience, seemingly, let's say, which is told in metaphoric terms, which is presented with metaphoric symbolism. And then,
because I don't think you can approach it directly. It's so ineffable that you have to use metaphor and comparison and everything that your culture and your subconscious and your upbringing, your education brings to you. That's the tools you have to describe something that's indescribable.
And those are exactly the things that a scientist, you know, with a capital S, would mm-hmm. would kind of be wary of.
And rightly so, because it's not science.
Yes, science is of its very static definition. There's a definition for science. I don't know what it is. I mean, I know you have to have a hypothesis and have repeatable experiments and all that stuff. But yeah, these experiences, these numinous experiences, which is a word I love, don't adhere to the scientific method. Yeah, and Whitley just did a couple of interviews with two scientists, one Ed Bell Bruno, who I've met, and another one who you just did an interview with, what was his name, the young fellow?
Deep Prasad.
Yes.
I thought he was kind of a snotty young kid. And I thought, well, who does he think he is? You know, And as I looked at what he was saying, because he's a creature of social media and of Twitter, at least, you know, in the way that somebody that's 24 years old is. And, you know, a lot of my friends were like I said, who is this guy? Who does he think he is? He doesn't even know the history of this. And after a while, I was thinking, he's basically doing what we all did, but he's doing it at like this incredibly accelerated pace. So when people would complain about his, you know, kind of, I don't know, not really bull in a china shop, but just his discovery of something that we had known, my friends and I had known for quite a while. You know, instead of saying, you know, well, you don't know anything, my attitude became, give him a minute. He's still learning. So with that in mind, I got in contact with him and I said, you want to do a show? And he finally agreed. And it was a wonderful, I mean, I had a great time. He had just announced like the day before on Twitter, before we recorded, he just announced his experience in his room with some strange thing, some kind of apparent contact type of experience. Broad daylight, 9:30 in the morning, he was perfectly awake when it happened.
Yes, remarkable. Yeah, Whitley talked to him recently too. Yes, just within the last week, I think. Actually, just this week's show. Yeah.
Yeah. And the fact that he would stick his neck out to admit that, I think he's just young and he's like, well, whatever, I don't care what people think, which is great. Because if he was like, you know, 40, 50 years old, an established scientist, I don't think we ever heard of it, ever would have heard of it.
Yeah.
But he, you know, he's younger. He wanted to talk about it. He wants to find out. He's got a, you know, this fire to get an understanding and an answer. And that to me was very exciting. And it was fun to talk to him about it because part of what I did in the show was partially trying to let him know, one, I think you're learning great stuff, but I also wanted to talk to him about stuff that interests me and you and people we know, like this side of it, the numinous side of it. And during the course of the interview, I said, you know, you should really talk to Whitley. I mean, this sounds like the stuff, a lot of stuff that he talks about and he's interested in. And I think they hit it off because of that. If Deep hadn't said anything on Twitter about this, I don't think this part of it would have opened up. And I think he needs to acknowledge that part of it, this weird part of it, not just the dry scientific part of it. And he's totally aware of that. And I think that's wonderful. And as time goes forward, I think he's going to make a big difference. And I'm glad that Whitley and other people that are not from the scientific community are that he's listening to them and able to talk to them, because that melding of the left and right brain and of the scientific and the science of the humanities, as Jeff Kripal says, you know, trying to get those to talk to each other about this subject, that's where, you know, some movement forward or at least some understanding is going to come from.
Absolutely. Hey, we need to take our very first break. For free Dreamlanders, you are going to hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Say yes to Serious Wonder. Unknown Country offers so much. Free Dreamland, a free weekly newsletter, free daily news, a thriving free message board. But it all depends on you becoming a subscriber. And you get so much more. Dreamland and special interview archives going back years. Vintage Dreamland from the broadcast days. live chats with our extraordinary guests. So say yes to Serious Wonder. Click on that subscribe tab on Unknown Country today.
The key, the mystery, the wonder. Now in a powerful new edition from Tarcher Penguin, Whitley Strieber updates the thrilling story with new revelations. Even the master of the key's most incredible predictions are coming true. We've discovered that there are many universes besides our own. He predicted this in 1998. He described how intelligent machines could be built. We're doing it now. If you love The Key, you need this new edition. And if you've never read it before, don't miss this beautiful book filled with true wisdom and true revelations. The Key is unique in this world. Graham Hancock says, "Consider its messages, and you'll find it has worked a kind of magic on you." The Key, a selection of the Quality Paperback Book Club, the Book of the Month Club, and the One Spirit Book Club. Available in paperbacks everywhere and online in all ebook formats. There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world. But you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and UnknownCountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Mercy Corps.
We are back on The Unseen with my guest, Greg Bishop, and we are talking about UFOs and how they... or let's say how they are understood and how they are perceived in our culture through the mainstream, through the people who've had the experience, as well as through the sciences. You interviewed Whitley, the host of this network, twice in the last month.
2 months, yeah. I think it was one. It turned out just barely made it twice in 2 months, yeah.
Okay, well, it's okay. And you also read his book, A New World. Now, I consider you really well-versed in like the lore of the classic contactee from years past. How does Whitley's message in A New World compare to what was once said, to like what was once the message?
To me, there's not a comparison because their message was basically world peace, but it was an outward-looking message, I guess I would say. Like everybody, you know, look what's going on around us. The world's going to blow itself up. We have to. There was a spiritual message in there too, but it was mostly anti-nuclear, anti-almost anti-military, anti-authoritarian, anti status quo type message. I mean, there the contactees to me were almost like, you know, flying saucer beatniks. Their message was, we're here to make you realize some things you don't realize, that the world is falling apart. And if you don't do something about it soon, it's going to fall apart worse. And so I think that was the main raison d'etre of the contactee movement, was just, it was a very anti-war, peace-oriented type of message.
Yeah.
But Whitley's book to me, New World, has that message updated to now, but you know, at least the part about the world's falling apart, you know, we got to do something about it. But his idea to me is that this change comes from within, it comes individually, and that if you're willing to open yourself up to what he calls the visitors, or at least their message, that this idea of self and planetary transformation comes from a very deep personal experience. And that's what I think the difference is. And I think that, you know, to me, that's an updated version. But like I said, with a lot deeper roots and a lot more personal relevance to people. And I've read his stuff for years. Even when people said, you know, Whitley doesn't, you know, who knows if this is happening or not? You know, is he lying? It's like, that's, to me, that's not the point with Whitley Strieber. To me, I was on, you know, the one time I was on and being interviewed by George Norrie, he said, who are your favorite researchers? He said, well, I said, well, Valet and Keel, certainly. Greg Little, who not too many people know about, he's still around. You got to have him on your show, actually. Right?
Yeah.
It'd be a good talk. And I said, and Whitley Strieber, and he said, what, Whitley? As a researcher? I said, yes. Think of the best scientist you could think of to be looking at this. You might come up with a Hynek or a James McDonald or a Jacques Vallée or somebody like that. Or maybe even Deep Prasad now. However, think of the best artist you could think of that is dealing with this subject. And I say, to me, it's Whitley. He's the best artist dealing with this right now. And people say, you know, do you think he's telling the truth? I said, that's not the point with me. That's like asking me if the Beatles were telling the truth. That's like asking me if Jackson Pollock was telling the truth. Like, that's not the point. The point is there's a message here that is not, it is a message of inspiration and a message that an artwork would give you, not something where you'd say, this pill works because, you know, in, you know, 9 out of 10 trials, it has been effective in doing whatever. That's not it. It's like, to me, looking at Whitley's work is like looking at a piece of art, and everybody gets what they can out of that piece of artwork.
And I'm coming from the place of being I worked as an illustrator and I did art and I studied film and stuff like that. So I feel like I'm pretty tapped into the need for art, and in good art, or the best art, let's say, will, like the best mythology in a way, will bypass the conscious mind and tap into that deeper hidden truth, and maybe truth with in italics, you know, truth that will never answer.
Yeah. Everybody goes to a concert and they all listen to the music. They're all hearing something different, but they're all hearing something that they like or that resonates with them. And that's how I feel about Whitley's stuff and some of the other literature, even your stuff. It's kind of like, stop categorizing this as, did this really happen? Was there a camera there or whatever? That's not the point. The point is to get something out of that in the midst of these words and images and all that, that it resonates with you. For the same reason that somebody like Stanley Kubrick or David Lynch will not describe to people what they're trying to do in their films, because they know as soon as they do that, it's going to collapse the waveform, so to speak, and people will say, oh, that's what that means. And the richness of what's going on in there that they might not even be aware of will be lost. You see what I mean?
I see exactly what you mean. And I'll go right to the parables of Jesus. I guess Jesus, and some of them, and many of them, he did kind of talk to his disciples and tell these stories about, you know, building a house on a strong foundation and whatnot. And then all the disciples were like, what is he talking about? You know, sometimes he'll come back and say, well, the foundation of the house means this and such. But
or it's like a Zen master, you know. Whitley's work to me is like a 30-year-long koan, you know, in a way.
Yes. And that's like a koan is meant to, you know, you're meant to, a koan is not meant to be solved.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. You don't solve it. Exactly. I don't think you're not there to solve what's going on with Whitley. What you're there to do is to absorb it and see what meaning that might have for you. And if there's none, that's fine.
You know, I had a conversation. This goes back a few years now. I had a conversation with Richard Dolan, and he sort of asked me like, you know, what do you think of Whitley Strieber? So he asked me, he wanted my opinion. He said, what do you think of Whitley Strieber? I said, you know, I recognize that he's a kind of divisive character in this field, and a lot of people have trouble taking him seriously or dismissive of him.
Yeah.
And I said that, you know, the issue is that he is such a good writer. So I've read a lot of first-person UFO abduction books, like a lot of them, like a kind of ridiculous amount. And some of them are so, I mean, like some of them are poorly written, right? But they're written with a kind of passion, but they're kind of tough to get through, some of them. But so Whitley writes this story, but he writes it at a level, like a way up there, at a different level. And so, like it's the problem, I think, the problem that some people, a lot of people, I don't know, but the problem that some people, and Rich and I really agreed on this, is that he is simply too good of a writer. Like, his writing is so beautiful that it, at times, it'll distract the reader from the... I can see how someone would say it sounds made up. The storytelling is too beautiful.
Yeah.
Now I think I'm saying this right. You know, Rich kind of lamented that and said, you know, he's really one of our top shelf writers. Like, he really is. And I recognize that's kind of a double-edged sword. It works against him at times. And he's like way out at the far edge of the continuum where he's struggling. Well, he's not struggling at all. He's clearly articulating the challenges that are all over this mess of a subject. And it's almost like the detractors simply can't keep up with him.
And do not get me wrong. I think that taking cameras out, doing what the UAP expedition is doing with Prasad, which isn't totally technologically scientific. There's other parts of it that aren't, which is great. Chris O'Brien's San Luis Valley Camera Project, stuff that Douglas Trumbull's doing, I think, still with his data acquisition thing for UFOs. That stuff is quite important. Databases and all this are important, but not to the detriment of the right brain, of what we're talking about here. I think they're equally important, that we just have to find out a way where they can talk to each other.
I agree. And that's actually that bridge. You know, I went to a UFO conference one time, or I've been to many UFO conferences, and I try to dress nice and my hair is short and stuff like that. So I can kind of talk to the guys with the mustaches who are looking at, government documents and, you know, sending Freedom of Information Act requests, or Freedom of Information Act requests to the Air Force and such. You know, these guys are on one side of this continuum, I guess. And I could kind of float over there and talk to those guys. And then I could float over to the ladies in the flowy dresses with the big earrings and talk about consciousness and angel spirits and stuff like that. And I felt really like a honeybee with all kinds of, you know, flowers that's a horrible analogy. Let me do something better. But I...
Point well taken. I think it's fine. I was about to say, that's kind of how I feel at these things. There's certain people I'm more drawn to, but the thing is that, you know, there's certain things I absolutely just am not interested in. And instead of complaining about it, I just ignore it. I mean, why waste time? But there's certain things that I'm interested in, and I will talk to those people about that. Many of my friends are diametrically opposed to each other, and that makes me happy, at least in their ideas about the subject.
Yeah. So what happened to me was I all of a sudden had this little name tag on the first time I spoke about UFOs and owls. Like, I had a little thing. It was like, it's a speaker and had my name on it. I was the guy who was going to talk about UFO abduction and owls. And I tell you what, I recognized it right away as soon as I had that new name tag on. I was persona non grata to half the room. To the nuts and bolts people, they didn't want anything to do with me.
Yeah.
And being purposely sort of provocative in the way I present this, but
I know.
And
I
that
know.
Said, you know, a few of them did say, I had no idea what you were talking about. I did not get this at all. UFOs and owls didn't make any sense. So I snuck into your talk, and then, you know, and they said, actually, it was really good. I liked it. And you made a good point. And so I'm not saying these people are not reachable, but I'm saying that there is a gulf. There are two sides to this lore.
It's a biggest Rorschach blot ever, you know. Well, reality is the Rorschach blot, but the study of UFOs, it's like, it's so factionalized based on what people's view of reality is, or whatever they're interested in. And, you know, to me, it's almost like, you know, I made a joke with some friends of mine. It's like two comic book people arguing over whether Batman can beat up Spider-Man or something. It's like, we're basically talking about the same thing here. So, you know, I think the factionalism is actually, it hurts things. It keeps that crosstalk from happening. So there's a lesson to be learned from some tolerance here and being able to listen to somebody instead of waiting for your turn to talk and not listening to what they're saying.
We have to take our second break. For free Dreamlanders, you're going to hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
You think that what subscribers to UnknownCountry.com get is just an archive or a rehash of what you can hear for free? Not quite true. Listen to this.
The Indonesian doctor is writing an article in the 1980s. This is more than 10 years after the mysterious German doctor has died. And now he's writing his recollections of that whole episode. And one of his recollections was that there was a small boy at one time when he first met the doctor in the island of Sumbawa. There was a small American boy living with him.
And that small American boy may very well have been the son of the mysterious doctor that Peter LaVenda is talking about. A special interview called Adolf Hitler in Asia. That boy went on to grow up, to come to the United States, to become a horrendous anti-Semite and serial killer. He was executed in Indiana in 2010. I'm telling you, you don't hear this anywhere else. Nowhere else. So come on, get on the stick. Become a subscriber to UnknownCountry.com. I guarantee you there is incredible information in our subscriber area, and we need you to keep supporting this. It's important. There's no place like it. No other website offers you the amazing riches of unusual and extraordinary information that we do. Subscribe today.
Ever wonder which Whitley Strieber books are available and where you can get them? Now you can go to Whitley Strieber's dedicated book website, Strieber.com, and shop for every Whitley Strieber item that's available. Many of them are available in electronic form, as well as hardcover and paperback. Experience the magic of transformation, the insights of breakthrough, the joy of miraculous journey. Join Whitley on the wondrous journey of that is his life. Thrill to his fiction, the magic of Orenda, the startling power of Alien Hunter, and so much more. Go to Strieber.com now and explore.
We are back on The Unseen, and we have my guest, my friend, Greg Bishop, and we are talking about UFOs and all the messy stuff that comes along with them. You often quote Kathleen Turner, the late abduction researcher. She wrote a beautiful book called Into the Fringe. Not beautiful, it's a pretty scary book, but a very well-written book.
Carla. Oh,
excuse me, Carla Turner. What did I call her?
Kathleen.
Kathleen Turner, okay. Kathleen Turner. Kathleen Turner was, she was the voice of Jessica Rabbit. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Okay. Let me start all over again.
That's okay.
You often quote, I might even leave this in. You often quote.
I think you should.
You often quote Carla Turner, the abduction researcher. And I think I'm doing the quote here justice. The truth is more likely going to be found in the anomalous details.
Yeah.
And why do you use that line? I've heard you use it many times.
Because this field, whatever interacts with us, and I think there is something interacting with us that's not us, it is not interacting with us in a way that is direct. Because if it was, there'd be no mystery, right? So what I think it does in the myriad of ways that it affects people is that it affects each person very individually, subjectively, etc. And that kind of stuff, to me, is more important. That's what I think Carla meant about anomalous details, meaning the stuff that doesn't fit. Because this whole thing doesn't fit. I mean, it just doesn't fit with anything. It's the trickster. It's absurd. It's all these.
Well, here, give an example if you can, like of a story that would fit the absurdity.
One of my favorites is a case from Poland. I think it was called a place called Emilcin, Poland, Emilcin, I'll try and shorten it. This was in the 70s. It was involved this old man that lived out in the country, didn't read papers, didn't watch TV, had no exposure to movies, anything like that. So front-loading and cultural cueing is out the door with this guy. He's driving his horse cart along a road in Poland, and these two guys, these two short guys next to the road, like kind of wave him down and ask for a ride. They don't say anything. They just kind of indicate they want a ride. And out there, he said, you know, if somebody wanted a ride, I'm going the same direction. Yeah, hop on the hay cart. So they jump in the back, and he says they start making these strange noises, and their feet look like flippers, and they kind of look oriental, or they got funny colored skin. I don't know if it's green or gray or what. And at one point, they kind of indicate that they're at their destination, and he looks in this field, and there's a thing that looks like a refrigerator hovering over the field. And at each corner of this refrigerator, or this, actually, it more looks like a square. What's that? One of those stainless steel trailers? What are those things called from the 50s?
The Airstream.
It looks like an air. It looks like a squared off Airstream trailer, but it's not just hovering in the field. It's cut four screw things turning on the side, like little screws, giant screws. What the hell are those things for? They take him into the field, and they motion to him to get to follow him. A platform comes down from the, you know, through on these, apparently on these ropes or something, comes down to the ground. He gets on the platform with them. He goes up, and he says he walks into this thing with them, and the door looks like a rolled up carpet. It doesn't look like any kind of a door. It just looks like some rolled up piece of fabric next to the door. In front of the door, there's a bunch of blackbirds, he said, that are struggling and looking like they're drugged or in some kind of distress, flopping around like crows. This sounds like a dream, doesn't it? They ask him to take off his clothes, and then they run some kind of device up and down him and then let him put his clothes back on. They tried to get him to eat something that looked like a icicle or a popsicle. He didn't want any.
Don't eat the food.
Yeah.
Don't eat the food when you're in fairyland, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then they, you know, then they basically lose interest and say, hey, you can, you know, emotion to him to get on the thing and go. So he goes and gets on the little platform. It takes him down to the ground, and he just gets in his cart and he drives away. It's just some weird thing that happened to him. He's like, oh, my, oh, my God, I saw a UFO. And he comes back to the village and he tells people, he's like, hey, I had this weird thing happen. They're like, huh, what? So some people are vaguely aware of that kind of thing. But to me, the point is that is such an absurd thing to happen. He wasn't disturbed by it. He didn't have any trauma over it, apparently. But, you know, it's what was going on there? I mean, did he see what actually was there? Or did he see, to me, this indicates he saw something that fits, you know, kind of what the narrative we think of as abductions. He'd never heard of such a thing. They didn't abduct him. They just said, hey, come on in. And he could have refused. And then I think there was a story later that UFO investigators finally got wind of it and came out and looked at the area. And I think they found some of those blackbirds' feathers in the field and a bunch of little footprints around where he said this thing happened. Not just his footprints, but other little footprints with him. Oh, also other people in the town saw this square thing go floating over the town, a kid and somebody else saw it. So anyway, to me, that's just so absurd. And of course, people would say, well, you know, actually, that's a screen memory and he actually had a real abduction. It's like, I don't think so. I think he had no idea what this should be. And his brain was just like, OK, well, that's what this is. And, you know, either while he was there or after the fact, he created a narrative that made sense to him. And I say that and people immediately say, oh, you said he made it up. I said, no. I didn't say he made it up. What I'm saying is that whatever happened to him, it was couched in metaphors and memories and ways that made sense to him, though it was absurd. I mean, like I said, it was like a dream. UFO experiences tend to be something that's describable. I mean, what else could you do? And for something to be describable, it has to be describable in with our imagery and our metaphors, and most importantly, our language. And so those things are going to determine what happens to somebody or how they remember it. What actually happens to them, I'm not sure. I've never been at an abduction. And I'm sure people that have had the experience and people that study it and people that are, you know, somebody like Kathleen Marden is probably going to say that, you know, I'm being too vague about it. But I think that the field itself is, I think we put so much meaning on it ourselves in order to be able to handle it and talk about it. That, and even, you know, abductees and witnesses and all this, they are using the tools that are available to them to describe something that's basically indescribable. So I think we have to be aware of that. That's basically what that my co-creation essay in the Reframing the Debate book was about. I've been thinking about this, and I'm still thinking about it.
I agree. I mean, we bring to the table our own baggage.
Yeah.
Just like with anything, we bring to the table our own baggage, you know?
Exactly.
And that same story, if that story was told instead of in a village in Poland in the 70s, if it was told in a village in Ireland 300 years ago, there would have been a rich lore already in place. And it probably would have been framed more as fairies or leprechauns. You know, they had that lore.
Yeah, this is the old passport to Magonia idea, but yeah.
So, I mean, they had, I mean, the if you lived in a village in Ireland 300 years ago, you would have had a cultural contamination the same way that we have a cultural contamination from watching the X-Files here.
Yeah. And I don't even know if it's a contamination. It's just the language and the mental language that is available to us. And without that contamination, I think we have nothing. You know, it's like, what are you going to do? You know, there are people that have UFO experiences or other kind of strange experiences, and they forget them until years later because there's nothing. You can't hang it on anything.
Yes. Or
you can't hang it on, well, this is like that.
Or that it could be that the you know, oftentimes it feels like, and I've talked to many people who said, oh, I just, this all came rushing back. And I have a couple of examples of that in my own stuff where it just feels like one little trigger and whoomp, this memory just slams back in place. And that often feels staged.
Yeah. Because it finds a hook to hook on somehow.
Or, and you know, another possibility, which is that the visitor energy, let's say the visitors are orchestrating the time and the moment that this needs to reemerge in someone's life. I can't prove that.
Yeah, possibly. I can't either.
Mac Tonies was so good. And this is a lesson I learned from him. He was so good at speculating. He was so good at speculating. He would say, now I'm going to speculate. And he would go riff and think about things verbally and just sort of extemporaneously speak about what may or may not have happened. And then he'd say, well, I'm done speculating. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're going to speculate, there's like, people are allowed to speculate and we're creative and we can come up with all kinds of things. And that makes scientists crazy.
Yes.
And I knew Bud Hopkins, and he would have these meetings, and he'd say, let's not speculate at all in this meeting. You know, the round meetings where everyone would come to his apartment and sit in a circle. And and that we're not going to speculate at all. Let's just tell what happened to us and our memories. And they all would. And then everyone, all the...
Yeah, but that's speculation.
Well, no, what they're telling, it's not speculating if they say, like, this is my direct memory. They're just repeating their direct memory.
Oh, okay. Well, okay.
But yeah. then everyone would go to the bar afterwards, and then they would all speculate like crazy, which I think we have to do as humans.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know what? I said that about Hopkins. No, I don't mean they're speculating, meaning it didn't happen to them. They're using the tools available to them to try and make sense of what happened to them. Now, if you want to call that speculation, fine. But yeah, it's like you said, it's more like describing directly what they think happened to them. But you have to realize that they're not describing what happened to them. They're describing their idea of what happened to them. Now, if you're talking about making bread or cleaning your car or whatever, that's really easy to describe. If you're talking about something you've never seen before that has come in the middle of the night and messed with your life and all that, to me, the only thing you can do is describe it in the metaphors available to us. And that's almost, to me, like speculation, but it's direct. You know, I don't know if I'm explaining this right.
Yeah, I get it. You know, so on Bill...
It's direct speculation or realistic speculation or something.
Yes.
Like that. And so the speculation you're talking about may be more involved with meaning and context.
and it comes out in the language of the dream. I mean, that's my thought now is like, you know, as a researcher, people tell me these stories and I'm like, okay, here, I'll give you one example. This fellow, Mike, it's in my second book. He has an experience. He's driving home from work. He's crossing a bridge. And right after he crosses the bridge, this owl flies in front of this windshield and scares him. It's full daylight. And then he drives another half a mile. He looks to his left and off on the side of the road, hovering above like a sewage treatment plant. It's not very, so is a copper colored flying saucer, and it's hovering there and it rises up into the clouds. He's caught in traffic and just has to get kind of drive along, and he loses sight of it. The most important part of that story to me was the bridge, right? So here's owls and UFOs tied together. This is my bread and butter. This is all I care about in some ways. Owls, UFOs. That's all I want. So he's got a perfect owl and UFO story. It happens at a bridge. Now, if you went to the dream analyst,
this is the big liminal thing that's a crazy.
Yeah,
right,
and
now.
So you say, I had a dream where I just crossed a bridge and I saw an owl, and then I saw a UFO. So there's these archetypes: bridges, owls, UFOs. They're steeped in this deeper meaning. This is what I'm sensing is emerging in this stuff.
Yeah,
this deeper meaning that we may never be able to articulate, the same way we cannot articulate what does the archetype of the hero really mean, right? We can say it means Luke Skywalker. It's like, yes, it does, but still, how is it touching you on a archetypal level in your deepest consciousness?
It encompasses so many other things. And it's also, the hero is an archetype in across cultures, and they're slightly different for each culture, maybe vastly different. Yeah.
And so are the little aliens, and so are the little beings that, you know, take a ride on your ox cart, right? I mean, they're different in Ireland, and they're different in the Southwest, and they're different in the Hudson River Valley.
They're different in Argentina in 1978 when, as the subject of that documentary, The Witness of Another World was describing. That doesn't sound like aliens either. It sounded like giant robotic things.
And you know what? When I watched that, you know what rang out to me? He climbed a ladder. Mm. I've read a thousand UFO accounts where people claim direct contact and abduction, whatever word you want to use. I don't know how many. I've never heard of anyone climbing a ladder. Maybe I have, but I'm just like, it's pretty rare.
Maybe Vias Boas, but I can't remember.
Yeah. So he climbed a ladder. Now there's an archetypal image, right? Talk about liminal. That's like a bridge, right?
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
got rungs on it. It goes up. You're ascending to a higher level.
Yeah.
That, I'm just riffing. I'm speculating. I'm doing the worst thing possible that a scientist, if any scientists are listening to this right now, their toes are curling in their shoes as I drone on and on. And
if mythology doesn't make any difference, if archetypes don't make any difference, if you don't think they're important, don't watch any more movies, don't read any more books, don't listen to any more music.
Don't go to the church on Sunday.
Don't go to church. If you don't think those things are relevant to the human experience, you're shutting out half or more of human experience. So to me.
Yeah. So we're confronted with a remarkably powerful human experience, changes people's lives. That's Witness of Another World. The man had a transformative experience, changed him. Mm-hmm. I had an owl experience. It changed me. I've talked to a lot of people who've had UFO experiences, changed their lives.
Yep.
So
Cosmic Art Project.
Yes. Here, go speak about that. That's one of my questions here.
I wrote something for UFO Mystic, the blog site, around 2008. What's that, 11 years ago? Called Are UFOs a Cosmic Art Project? And it was speculation, right? And what my speculation was, you know, I'll go to the crux of it. If you could affect somebody's life in the way that 30 seconds or a minute of a UFO sighting affects somebody's life that we know about, you know, you would be the most famous artist ever. I just showed you something that completely changed your idea of what reality is. What could be more powerful than that? So what's going on there? Is something using, you know, our subconscious and our way of looking at things to either convey a message or just to say, look, I'm here, or to say, look, there's a different way of looking at reality than you think. These things, you know, change people's lives. So the only other thing I could think of that touches people that deeply is art and music in a way that you cannot analyze directly. So that was my point. Like there's a whole, you know, this was written before the co-creation stuff I wrote, and it directly fed into it.
Oh, I got 1,000 questions I want to ask you.
Okay. I hope I can keep it up for 1,000 questions.
So Project Beta, you did a book. Mm-hmm. When did that book come out?
2006, I think. 5 or 6.
2006. Okay. Wow. Okay. So 15 years ago.
Long time.
Yeah. So if that book came out, and now in that book, you talk to a lot of, let's just call them secret keepers.
Yep.
And much of your research involves your interactions with, secret agents. I don't know what they're even the right term with. People who are keeping secrets. So they're feeding you little tidbits. Some of those tidbits might be misinformation, disinformation. But I sense that you have learned to navigate those waters, at least a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the book Project Beta about?
It's about a UFO researcher that was led into something that basically made him have a nervous breakdown over a course of a few years by elements of the Air Force, the NSA, CIA, whoever was working at this base in Albuquerque that he lived next to and was seeing strange lights. And it was part of a counterintelligence operation and basically a way to get Russian agents to reveal themselves and also to protect assets in Russia and also to protect our projects, United States military projects in the United States. This is one tiny little part of it. But for the impact on ufology is still being felt. And it created a lot of fear, paranoia, mistrust between UFO researchers and especially with the government and, in some cases, well-founded and deserved, and in other cases, probably taken a little too far because there's a lot of drama queens in ufology.
And there's, yes, and I'm in and now let's fast forward to present day with your background, with your foundation and exactly that kind of those issues, which it's a minefield. It's a house of mirrors with a quicksand floor, right? Once you get into that world.
Oh, yeah.
What are your ideas about Tom DeLonge in this To the Stars Academy that's emerging presently?
Wow, people keep asking about that. And
you can have a short answer, but I'm genuinely curious.
Well, my shorter answer is it's not the same thing. It might not even be similar. I don't think DeLonge is being Benowitzed I don't think he's being drawn into something that will eventually drive him crazy. I don't think that's the case. What I do think is that on the very face of it, there's a group I described in, Project Beta, and everybody knew about this group called the Aviary, and people seem to think it was this official government group that studied UFOs. It was not. It was a bunch of people interested in the subject. John Alexander was in the group, Hal Puthoff was in the group, that informally met with each other and tried to figure out an answer, just like we're all trying to figure out, what's going on here. But they thought they had better access to government sources of information, and they could utilize these things. And it didn't really quite work out for them because they didn't have access or the answers weren't there or whatever. So they moved on. And I think one of the latest incarnations of this is Tom DeLonge and To the Stars. People that, for whatever, whatever else they may be doing, which I'm sure is plenty, I think they still have a genuine interest and don't know what the answer is. And they're still trying to find that answer, just like we all are. It's just that they're doing it through, their lens, which is intelligence, former intelligence, aerospace industry, all that stuff. And then on top of that, obviously, as I've said straight out, they're trying to make money off it by finding something exploitable in the UFO lore and UFO, physical evidence of UFOs, maybe crash retrievals, whatever you want to call it. They're trying to find something exploitable so that they can either, both advance human knowledge and two, make a decent amount of money by patenting some of these ideas that may either come from UFOs or inspired by them. And then on top of that, you know, they have the entertainment. They're trying to do TV shows. They didn't make that unidentified show, but they were the subject of it. And I think they had a heavy consulting hand in it. So,
and I think that was Tom DeLonge's thing right from the start, that we're going to make this a pop culture thing. We're going to do books. We're going to do comic books. We're going to do T-shirts. We're going to do TV shows.
Yeah.
So if, you know, whether he was, he didn't do it himself, but he probably was in a position to sort of fast track that in the direction.
Yeah. Know. I mean, people may think I'm naive about it and all that, but I kind of don't want to speculate because I don't know what they're doing. I don't know what goes on in their office every day when they talk. I have no idea. I'm sure there's a way more going on there than they tell people. That's any company is like that because they have to keep some stuff close to their vest. Now, if we're lucky, something significant will happen and they'll tell us about it in some way. If we're not, it just becomes something where suddenly, you know, there's something that can teleport from one place to the other. And, you know, you trace some of the patents back and they go to people associated with them. I don't know. But if nothing else, however much people want to badmouth them or whatever, I am neither for nor against them. I'm just interested. I'm quite interested in what they're doing. It's one of the weirdest and most significant and most interesting, actually, things that's happened since I've started looking at this stuff, and I'm sure most people listening. And on that level, it's interesting. You just have to pay attention. Don't get excited. Don't freak out. You know, don't take sides, but watch. Watch and see what happens.
Yeah, that's my sense, too. Like, it's... I'm interested and I want to pay attention. And if it is disinformation, my understanding of disinformation is you got to hide, you're using real experiences and real events and such to hide something, right? So if they're saying 10 things, you know, 8 or 9 of them might be true. And then one of them might be meant to lead us astray. And I don't know which is which.
But... Yeah, I don't know either. It's the title of the first chapter in the collection of my stuff. Called It Defies Language. The very first chapter is that interaction I've had with those people. And the title of the chapter is you play the game or you get nothing. So that means you've got to interact. You've got to listen. You've got to talk to people and not worry about whether you're being fooled or not. People's like, I got to know the truth. I have to know if this is the truth or not. It's like, well, then you shouldn't be around it. Because if you can't reserve your judgment about what you're being told, about what you're seeing, about what you've been allowed to see, whatever it is, if you can't reserve judgment on that and not get excited and not get, you know, try to keep the emotion out of it so that you have a clearer view of what's going on, you shouldn't be messing with it. Every semester, I lecture to a class called UFOs and Culture. And during question and answer session, this is at a school here in Southern California University. There's a question and answer session afterwards. They show Mirage Men, the thing about Project Beta and beyond. And the questions, you know, have gotten more interesting, especially since the TTSA Tom DeLonge stuff, because younger people are like, oh, you know, they know who he is. They know what's going on. They pay attention. So what they asked me, first question was, how do you know when you've gone too far and you've probably gone off the deep end? And I thought, I didn't really thought about that. I thought about it for a second and I said, when you can't think of anything else except UFOs, you've probably gone too far. And the other thing I said was, and I've seen this happen to friends of mine, the UFO subject, if you've got a loose thread on you somewhere, it will grab that thread and just unravel you as fast as it can if you're not careful. it's not a subject for people that have some other problems in their life, like the occult. Israel Regardi, who was a secretary for Aleister Crowley, and you know, popularized the Golden Dawn and Crowley's occultism. He said, if you're going to get into this, into the occult, you should probably go through a heavy session few sessions of psychotherapy to make sure that you're actually ready for this and you're not doing this because you think you can get one up on people, or as I say, when you get to smite. If your ego is such that it gets tickled by the UFO subject, the UFO subject is going to pull that string so hard that you won't know what happened, and you're going to turn into your senses will leave you, and you will either become a person with a strange cult following you, or you'll just be somebody that just sounds completely crazy. People out that don't agree with you. So yeah, it's the UFO subject is just it's crazy inducing. And so you have to kind of be ready to be on those stormy seas and be okay with it.
I have been on those stormy seas, and that's, I feel much more grounded now, but there was a chapter in my life where exactly that thread got pulled, and I...
Me too.
I've said this over and over again, and I'm not exaggerating. I spent between about 2006 and 2010... spent every waking hour wondering if I had gone insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the way it calmed down, as silly as it sounds, I think I got bored of it, like being so frazzled.
Me too. Do you know who Paul Krassner is? He used to put out a magazine called The Realist. He died recently. He was one of the yippies in the 1960s. He was in the Weathermen and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to him once, and I think I put this in Project Beta. And I said... He was talking to me about when he was researching the Kennedy assassination, he thought people were following him. He was paranoid, everything. And I went through this too, not with the Kennedy assassination, with the UFO stuff. And I said, well, how did you stop? What stopped it for you? And he said, I got tired of it. I got tired of feeling scared all the time. And that's exactly what happened to me, Mike. And that sounds like what's happened to you. We all went through it in different ways, but it's like, God, if I keep on this way, I'm going to be a babbling idiot, and I don't want to do that. So why don't I just back off?
You know what I did, actually? It was a collision of two things. These owls, which are a symbol was interfering with my life. The owl is an archetypal symbol. Mm-hmm. And I went into the woods one day. This would have been in 2009, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I literally spoke aloud. I hiked this little trail and found this pleasant little spot in the woods. And I said, this is not working. It's not working. You're trying to get my attention. It's not working. It's too much. You got to back off. And I said, I will not pay attention. I was seeing so many owls at that point. It was absurd. I said, I will not pay attention to owls unless they cross my path. An owl like over on the fence post over there, that doesn't count. You know, because that's what I was seeing. I'd ride my bike and, oh my God, there's an owl on the fence post. There's an owl up in that tree. There's like, you know, and it was, they will not count. I will not pay attention to an owl unless it crosses my path. Mm-hmm. And a couple days later, I was riding my bike down the main street of the town and I saw this owl in a tree on the right side of the road. And I rode my bike along. It swooped down low and passed in front of me. I probably couldn't touch it with my hand, but it was pretty close. Mm-hmm. And then it landed in a pine tree on the other side of the road. So I felt like I asked a question. I was asking.
Yeah.
Can you do this for me? And it felt like it happened. They did it. Now, who that they may be is a slippery slope. I can't answer that. But I asked a question. I had a request. My request was granted. And it chilled me out so much.
Yeah. Self-therapy. And who knows, you know, maybe it was just a matter of perspective for you. Just to change your own perspective. That's another thing. When I was talking to those kids at the college students, kids, what I explained to these kids when they asked me about being paranoid, and you know, I said I was tired of it. The funny thing was, I was having everything I got from Carla Turner was opened or mutilated or lost, and also a cattle mutilation researcher, Peter Jordan, who got out of it a long time ago, right in the middle of when I was talking to him about it too. But what I said to myself was, I'm tired of being paranoid about this. I'm just going to stop it. You know, cold turkey almost. I'm going to stop being paranoid about everything. Stop noticing things that upset me. The weird thing was when I made that decision, the mail tampering stopped. Is that a coincidence? Because the mail tampering wasn't something I was imagining. It's like a mutilation. The mail was mutilated. I got these notes saying, oh, sorry, our, you know, our machines like messed up this envelope, and the envelopes were open. Some of them obviously opened and taped back. But it's when I made the decision to stop being afraid, either by coincidence or coincidence is a slippery word, but the physical manifestation of my paranoia stopped when I decided to stop being paranoid. So what is that? There's, you know, I'm going back into co-creation again.
Yeah, the truth is more likely to lie in the anomalous details. And this odd stuff, this really weird stuff, I mean, I'm drawn to it. Like, it floats my boat.
Me too.
Man, the weirder and the more dreamlike and the more symbolic and the more mythic. And I say this straight up all the time. I did not choose the owls. The owls chose me. And I feel like I am grateful that I didn't get, you know, I'm grateful that the thread that I have been pulling on has been just so full of this. The owl stories have
You're pulling a this string and pearls are coming out.
Yes, and also that the experiences that people are sharing, some of them are very scary. I have a handful of like really downer experiences that are connected to owls, but very few. Most of them are people are challenged. People are really challenged, but they have a kind of a benevolence to them, and I am so grateful. And I'm projecting big time in saying that. I recognize that. I'm fully aware of that. But it's been a remarkable journey these last 10 years. Hey, Greg, how do people get a hold of you?
Probably best through, I guess, Facebook or commenting on my at Radio Misterioso, which is my interview show, which I've been doing since 1997 or 8 under different names.
21 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I started out on a pirate radio station in LA, FM Pirate Radio. Eventually the FCC busted us and shut down the station, but I started interviewing people then, and it was called Hungry Ghost then, which is a Buddhist term. Somewhere around 2006 or something like that, I started, I guess, interviewing people in earnest, not just playing music, but I would call up and, you know, actually conduct interviews with people. And so, you know, I started Scott Corrales, I talked to very early on, who some people know, Mike Marinacci, who was one of the co-authors of Weird California, which was another book I was involved in. He wrote a book called Mysterious California. I think I had Ira Einhorn once on my show, the unicorn killer guy. But yeah, and since then, I've probably interviewed, I don't know, 300 or 400 people. And some of it's in the archive on the site if you just start going down the list. But if you want to get in touch with me, just comment on the sidebar there or message me on Facebook or whatever. And I will, if I see it and if I don't answer right away, I apologize. But yeah, the best way is probably either through the Facebook group for Radio Misterioso or the radio show page itself, RadioMisterioso.com. It's spelled like Spanish.
Good. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah. I've met so many great people through this, and I'm sure you have too, Mike. It's just some of my best friends have come through just studying this weird stuff. I mean, we realize we're of the same stripe. We both like anything that's extremely strange, and everything and all the wonderful things flow from that.
You know, and when Whitley asked me to do this show, this podcast, my first thought was like, ooh, I get a chance to talk to all my friends.
Yeah, exactly. About
and that's what
a
I've
third
been doing
of the
in
people
a way,
I so. Talk to on my show are just friends of mine, and we're just hashing stuff out and having fun, you know, or more importantly, what the guest is into. Deep Prasad, I had him on. The first thing I asked him was like, what the hell is quantum computing and how does it work? And I didn't ask him that because I was trying to get on his good side. I asked him because I truly wanted to hear from somebody that was in that industry and knew what it was, how it worked. And he gave me a great explanation, and we went on from there.
And that's what I did with you. I asked, you know, like, what's up with the UFOs? We didn't solve anything.
There's nothing to solve. I stopped thinking of this as solving. I think of it now as an individual understanding. If that individual understanding meshes with other people's individual understandings, then that's maybe sort of what you might call an answer.
And that may be the best we get in the short term. Who knows what the future will bring? Greg, it's been a delight.
Definitely. Thank you so much. I had not that I didn't think I was going to have fun, but this turned out to be like way more fun than even I thought it would be. Thank you.
That's what I wanted. That was what I was hoping for. And hopefully the audience picks up on that too.
Hope so. Thanks, Mike.
You're very welcome. This is Mike, and I am chiming in after the editing. I would like to thank Greg for his time and energy, and I need to say it was my sincere honor to talk with him and have a few laughs. Here's to a new year, and hopefully conversations like these will bring hope and strength to our troubled world. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. Bye now.